Shall we begin? This is the world of the beauty and glory of life that Ashwapati is now seeing. Marvel, marvel and rapture wandered in the ways. It's everything, wherever you look, whatever you see, is a wonder. This is how to look at things. We see things with eyes that are ordinary. And we see the ordinary world. If we know how to see, we see all things as marvelous. There is a very beautiful line Sri Aurobindo sometimes speaks of. It is not his. It is by Blake, who says, when the gates of perception are cleansed, we see all things as they truly are, infinite. It is our gates of perception, our senses, our seeing, our hearing. In front of this perception, we have our own opinions, our own attitudes, our own judgment. So we never see things for what they are. We see them through our mental formations. You remove all these formations, you remove all the screens between yourself and the truth, and you see all things as an expression of the divine. So we see all things as they truly are. If you remove the ego, the blindness, the opinions, the judgment, the preferences, these things that come between ourselves and what we experience. So that is when we see all, wandered in the ways means everywhere. Wherever you look, everything is marvelous. Everything is beautiful. Because the person who is seeing is pure. The person who is, the eyes who is feeding, is free from blindness or from smallness, the pettiness of his nature. Only to be was a supreme delight. Life was the happy laughter of the soul, and joy was king with love for minister. So this is the kingdom of beauty and love and joy. This is the purest ananda. Why is it like that? Because the spirit's luminousness was bodied there. Every form was a manifestation of the spirit. That is why. Every shape, every existence is an expression of the soul. The spirit's luminousness was bodied there. Life's contraries were lovers or natural friends. Yes, in the play of manifestation there is diversity. It is not repetition, it is not sameness. So in that diversity, there is a play of apparent opposition. What is small and what is big? What is high and what is low? What is near and what is far? All these are contraries. They are not opposites. They are simply different manifestations of the one. But we look at them as opposites. Life's contraries were lovers or natural friends. And her extremes, keen edges of harmony, the extremes of life, extremely beautiful, extremely powerful, extremely gentle, extremely sweet, all these extremes. Without these diversity, you can sit there, Lalit. Unless you have variety, you cannot really have harmony. In music, you have to have various notes to create harmony. It's not the same note. It's not the repetition of the same idea. It's not the repetition of the same definition of what is beautiful that makes things complex, complete, varied, and rich. There has to be variation. That is the one becoming the many. And each aspect of the many is different from the next one. And yet each aspect is in its own nature, in its own entity, absolute. That is, therefore, when we are in this mental state, we have definitions. That this is correct, that is not. This is right, that is not. What I have defined as right is right, the rest is not. Here in the world of pure life, the play of all this variation is like all the notes of music. They combine to create a richer harmony. You don't play the same note over and over again. So there were keen edges of harmony. Indulgence, with a tender purity, came and nursed the god on her maternal breast. Even indulgence, usually used for as a kind of a criticism, when you allow or permit the play of a weakness, accept some kind of what you may call fault, allow it out of love. Sometimes it is described the indulgence of a mother. The mother allows her son to take part in things that he should not do because she loves him, because she is his mother. An indulgent mother does not correct her child at every step. So this is at times described as a bad mother. She should pull up her child. She should show him the right way. But what is the right way? That is where the problem arises. The right way that he should follow is defined by her understanding. But if she allows the other, the child, usually it's used between a play of mother and child, to follow his own natural instincts. They are expressions of his being. Sometimes the inner expressions of his being that may not agree with the moral or virtuous definitions of what one might say is right, what one must say is good. So that is also part of this world of life. He's describing the play of the world of the vital. He's not talking of something above the vital. But in the world of the vital itself, the vital is a projection of a supreme energy, the energy of creation, of manifestation. So this play is rich, is multiple, and does not fall within the strict framework of morality. Mental morality. But it can be risky, and that is why the fall of life. It can take us a little, permit our weaknesses to dominate us to such an extent that we lose touch with the higher part of our being. That danger is there always. But he is describing this field of the vital world where the divine ananda, the divine delight of existence in all manners is really as if it breaks out into all the complexity and richness and variety of life. Indulgence with a tender purity came, with the tenderness, the love of the mother, and nursed the god on her maternal breast. That is, it's like a mother who is spoiling her child. She's not spoiling the child. She's bringing up the child with love. And that love that she is really transmitting to her child may help the child to feel the inner core of love that is there behind all things. A child who has never been brought up with love is a being who is very poor, poor in the sense, does not have the wealth of sweetness and love that the mother can give. So that is the whole secret of existence, is if the mother permits the child to fall, to follow his desires, but she is there to be there holding him. She's holding him up, nursing him, looking after him. So she nursed the God from the human to the divine manifestation of gentleness, of sweetness, of simplicity, of even childlikeness on her maternal breast. There, none was weak. So falsehood could not live. It's an extraordinary line. It tells us what is falsehood. Falsehood is a form of weakness. It is born of fear. Fear is weakness. It is because we are afraid to see the truth, to live the truth, to face the truth, to speak the truth. That is why we avoid the truth and turn towards something which is untrue. But if there is absolute purity in us, fearlessness, a child who has never been, for instance, punished for being whatever he is, doesn't have to tell a lie. But when a child feels that if I say this, I will be punished, then he tells a lie. That is the whole responsibility also of those who are nurturing, who are helping the child to grow. There has to be always an atmosphere of love, of understanding, of compassion, of sympathy. Then falsehood does not have to be expressed. He doesn't have to tell a lie. We have the instances of the child god. In India, we have so many stories of the child god Krishna, who has spent so many years in his childhood doing all the things that we are not supposed to do. And yes, he enjoyed it. He stole, he lied, he did things that one doesn't approve of. But he was still the supreme. He was the divine. At the same time, for a little while, it seems it is as if his mother says, "What are you doing? Everybody is complaining about you. You are doing this, you are doing that, you should not do. You're stealing a laddu, open your mouth." So he opened his mouth and she was flabbergasted. She saw the universe in his mouth. So this notion of mental, moral fixity that the rules of the mind have created often are the cause of so much error. We do not have to instill fear in the child. If there is no fear, the child is not weak. There none was weak, so falsehood could not live. Ignorance was a thin shade protecting light. It is not the world of the highest level of consciousness. Light is the principle that is at work in all things. At this level of the vital, there was one layer where that light was a little dimmed. It is like we have to train our eyes to be able to look at the light. We don't know how to look at the light. So you wear some dark glasses. It hurts you. So you have to shade your eyes. It is not the light that has to be dimmed. It is our nature that has to be readied, prepared to be able to face the light. Imagination, the free will of truth. Often the word imagination is associated with make-believe, thinking that you are imagining it, it is not true. It's true. It's true in the world of imagination. That's one of Mother's talks in the Wednesday class, I still remember. If it exists in your imagination, it exists there. It's not that it doesn't exist at all. What exists in the material world in front of you is not the only existence. There is another. There are so many worlds, world on world, in the world of your images. Imagination is an image-making faculty. You make an image in your mind. That image is true. It doesn't correspond to any material fact. Maybe, not yet. But it probably will correspond to a fact in the future. All great achievements, inventions, creations begin with imagination. One has to dream. One has to imagine. One has to build a world in one's heart, in one's mind, in one's spirit, before it can be projected into the physical universe. So it is not as if imagination is false. It is perhaps truth that is waiting to manifest, waiting in its own world. Someday, somewhere it will happen. And that is how we can proceed. We have to have a goal of something that we move towards, something not yet achieved. One day I will be that. One day I will reach that. That is in the book, in the poem Love and Death, that Sri Aurobindo has described in his own words, that it is, he has not written better poetry than that, in that poem. It came like a flood. And there the young hero says, he's challenging death. This man's greatest enemy is death. And he says, someday, I know not when, somewhere, I know not where, but I will confront thee. That notion that somewhere, someday, death will be confronted. And that is exactly the theme of Savitri. It is an imagination that one can overcome death, because it has not been overcome yet. But it is the first dream of man. That is how the life divine starts. No, the earliest preoccupation of man is God, light, freedom, immortality. Immortality is a dream of immortality. Is it an impossibility? The young children I have in my class now, they call it an impossibility. They discuss it and they say, this is not possible, death is inevitable, it cannot be. Because I suppose they have been too nurtured by the practical outward fact of things. They have to be allowed to dream that because it has never happened is the reason why it should be made to happen. What has never happened will not happen tomorrow, but there has to be a time when it will happen. Otherwise, what's the point of evolution? Why should life continue repeating the same circuit over and over again? The circle has to be replaced by another one, a higher spiral. And that is the whole point. Life is a continuous process. It's not a fixed, final process. Birth and death is a cycle. Birth to a new birth and a still greater birth will be the ultimate cycle, where there will be endless manifestation, endless growth. That possibility, if we utter it today, we are looked upon as madmen, as foolish, as dreamers. Well, these are the ones who create the future. There has to be dreamers. Otherwise, there is no point. Imagination, the free will of truth, because it doesn't fall into the category of logic. Pleasure, a candidate for heaven's fire. Pleasure is looked upon also as something that drags us down from the world of true joy. Yes, it is an inferior joy, but it is a starting point of the movement towards delight. So it's a candidate slowly for heaven's fire. The creative energy is ananda. That is the heaven's fire. Fire is energy. The intellect was beauty's worshipper. This is something where intellectuals are supposed to be dry in their minds. They are supposed to be logical, philosophical, argumentative. Beauty is a term they rarely connect with. Or beauty is a formula. For an intellectual, beauty may be a formula, a rational formula, which is something that has been transcended by the true intellectual. You want one of the great intellectuals, like Einstein. He wrote a letter to his daughter, which he told his daughter, "You publish it after I have gone." And he is supposed to be represent one of the heights of the intellectual achievement, the scientific achievement. He says, behind all this is the mystery of the divine beauty, the presence of something that the intellect cannot experience. When you've gone far enough, you have to recognize the play of the divine harmony. Harmony is beauty, beauty of form. The creation is a form, the universe is a form, it's a projection. But it is not a fixed formula. When you belong to the lower levels of the mind, even beauty is put into certain formulas. Classical beauty has its rule, has its rules, has its norms. Classical music has its rules, has its norms. It falls into certain patterns, categories. That's a start. It breaks out of those rules. You reach a state of flawless harmony. All possibilities of manifestation. And that is a mystical experience. And that is what that particular gentleman has experienced. And it would overturn all that he had said, that this universe, which he saw it as a play of energy, is actually grace. It's grace, it's love, it's beauty. That is holding up creation. This is the letter that he wrote and told his daughter, "You don't show it to anybody until after I've gone." The intellect was beauty's worshipper. Strength was the slave of calm spiritual law, whereas in our world of the vital, a person whose vital is very strong, strength becomes a dominant expression of his ego, his pride. He dominates with the strength. Strength that is calm. The strength of the spirit, the strength that doesn't need to broadcast itself as something that is almighty, all-powerful. It is naturally powerful. A natural quietness and strength. Power laid its head upon the breasts of bliss. This is the ideal vital world. Power is not the same as strength. Strength is really physical, in the physical body. Power is a principle of mastery, not just physical. Power can blind you. Power usually takes us on the paths of greater egoism, greater domination, but to be surrendered to joy, to offer it oneself to love. To love, you give your power as an expression of love, and that gives joy. So these are the highest experiences of the world of life on the vital plane. And then this same plane will take up to the world of the gods, because there are gods on every level. So this world of life has its own gods, who are all perfect. Every world has its gods. There were summit glories, inconceivable, the highest gods. So we have a whole hierarchy of gods, the highest god, and then the gods below them, and then the gods still below them. Each one in his own field, on that level, is perfect, is complete. Autonomies of wisdoms still self-ruled. Autonomy is self-rule. You rule yourself, you don't need to be ruled. You need a government when you are not capable of governing yourself. But if you can govern yourself, you don't need to be told what to do. That's self-rule. So these are the different forms of rule. Autonomies of wisdom still self-rule. That is what is wisdom. That there is a, it's a state of inner illumination. Wisdom is not knowledge. Wisdom is a state of inner light, where you are in touch with your inner self. That self puts you in a state of quietness. You don't respond with violence, because your own way of thinking, your own way of believing is not being accepted by the others. These debates are not required. And high dependencies of a virgin son. These are forms of government. Dependencies were states, political states, which were, and in the early, there were periods where there were certain states that were not independent essentially. Today it's not the same, but there was a time for example, at a place like Bhutan, for instance. Today Bhutan is an independent country. Yeah. It was a dependency. That is to say, it was independent in everything except that it had no right to an army. It could not have an army, so whenever and it could not establish trade with other countries. These were the two conditions. A dependency is a state which had to pass through a greater state, like in the Bhutan for India. India had to permit that state to establish trade connections with other countries. And it could not have an army. That was a dependency. In every other way, it is an independent state. Today, Bhutan is not like that. It is an independent country. But there was a time when it was like that. So dependencies are those states of life where you, for fundamental issues, you need a greater help, a greater guidance. Otherwise, you learn to look, you have the right to your own life. We have a right to our own choices. You make our own choices. We can make our own mistakes. We have to come out of those mistakes. But for certain decisions in our life, it is always best to depend on a greater power. That greater power is the ruler. If we can do that, if a nation can always rely on that greater power, which is the divine, which is the supreme, who controls the destiny of the nation in the world of life. That nation will rise. But if that nation is blinded by its own wealth, its own importance, its own power, as it can happen, it often gets derailed, as it often happens also. Ambition, power, wealth takes us off the track. So these are different forms of rule. High dependencies of a virgin sun. Sun is the source of light. So you are dependent on the sun. That sun is the highest, the purest source of light. And if the community or the collectivity, we live in a community or a collectivity, if that community or that city that you are living in today in Oroville has kept constantly that consciousness that it is the Supreme who is really the highest authority of that community. It's the divine. You have to be a willing servant of the truth to be able to live there. It's the same thing in the ashram. In any community, it is not anything other than that. It is the sun, the supreme. The sun is the supramental presence. All things are expressions of that sun, provided you remain completely surrendered, loyal, self, you have given yourself to that sun. High dependencies of a virgin sun. Illumined theocracies of the seeing soul, another form of government. Theos in Greek is God. There were certain states which were where religion was the ruler. Even now, the principle in Tibet is that the Dalai Lama is the supreme ruler. So a theocracy, there was in the Middle Ages, there were city-states in Italy like Venice. Venice was very powerful because it was a trading center. It was at the crossroads of the world where the highest authority was the cardinal. The highest political authority was the cardinal. So this is also a dangerous thing where religion becomes politics. That is the danger. When you read European history, you will see so many wars, so many empires which were controlled by the Pope. The Pope was the spiritual leader. The Pope became one who controlled the military power of the state. It is very difficult to remain an illumined theocracy. A theocracy which is always in touch with the divine, because theos is God, where God rules, not man, to be a channel of the divine force. That is the important thing. There are clashes inevitably, unless the ruler is at least tries to be open to the divine or the supreme power. That was the principle also in Tibet, where the supreme spiritual leader was also the supreme political leader. Of course, the Chinese came and they tried to change that, but that is how it had been for centuries. So, these are different forms of government. Illumined theocracies of the seeing soul. The ruler is the soul, the conscious soul. The soul in us is there, but it is hidden behind many layers of neglect, of being pushed into the background, of forgotten. The soul takes over. Throned in the power of the transcendence ray, these rulers These theocracies are in the light of the Supreme. They rule with the light of the Supreme, the transcendence ray. Then you have illumined theocracies. Otherwise, these theocracies can be the starting point of great dictatorships. A vision of grandeurs, a dream of magnitudes, in sunbright kingdoms moved with regal gait. The aspect of greatness that empires really embodied. Why has becoming an emperor been such a great dream for a few? Sri Aurobindo has mentioned in some of his plays also. What was Alexander? He was not just a man. Why did he feel the need to conquer so much of the world? That is part of the greatness of the vital. There is always the other side, the flip side, where you can make that the starting point of a downfall, which happened to each of them. To all of them, they fell. They had terrible downfalls. But when they conquered, they were not men. They became embodiments of greater powers. They were Napoleon or Alexander or Caesar or Samudragupta, which you have not Chandragupta only, Samudragupta. He created the whole empire in the Southeast Asia. All of Southeast Asia, Indonesia, all these, they were all conquered by him. So these rulers have to have a tremendous wideness of vision also to take over as much of the known world that they are capable of taking over and mastering it with their vision. There is a certain greatness of the vital that is there. With that, if you can stay in touch with the divine power, you become a medium of great expression. If you don't, it becomes the starting point of a great downfall. Usually, power leads to a downfall because the ego, the vital ego, begins to become very, very predominant. But this is the glorious aspect of life. A vision of grandeurs, a dream of magnitudes, in sun-bright kingdoms, moved with regal gait, assemblies, crowded senates of the gods, life's puissances reigned on seats of marble will, as if they become the governors, the rulers in the world of life. Assemblies or senates, they are like those who help with the governance of an empire, of a ruler. High dominations and autocracies. High dominations, no, you have the different hierarchies in society. You have from the common man, you have barons and counts and dukes and ultimately kings. Or in the world of religion, you have the ordinary priest, and then from that the bishop, the cardinal, the pope. This kind of sense of domination, this sense of hierarchy. In the world of life, there is always a sense of hierarchy. Somebody who is at the top. Others do what the person at the top commands. High dominations and autocracies. They rule themselves. And laurel strengths and armed imperative minds. In the Greek tradition, the victor was usually given a crown of laurels. Laurels are leaves. A crown of leaves which was put on the head of the victor shown that he is the winner in a race, in a competition. So laureled victors, laureled, you might say, strengths are great emperors, rulers who take over the authority and the power. All objects there were great and beautiful. This is the world of the human thirst for greatness. There is one aspect in the nature of the vital, not just for pleasure, but also for greatness. Not for the sake only of power, but there is an attraction for something splendid, something that is exceptional, to be drawn towards that. There are a few who are really drawn. That is the whole thing. This mother recounted the story of Julius Caesar. He had to cross a river in order to meet the enemy. That river was in spate, you know. And the boatman said, "Sir, the boat may drown." Caesar said, "You are taking Caesar, don't forget. The boat will not drown." That sense of greatness, it will not drown. You are taking Caesar across. He was conscious of his supremacy. He has shaped the Roman world. That is why he could not be accepted. He was killed. But he is the shaper, the maker. So that river that was in spate, he told the boatman that, "You are taking Caesar across. How can the boat drown? It will not drown. Wait for me to cross the river and then..." So this sense of human splendor, it is not just ego. There is a grandeur. There is a marvel. That's why we also worship the gods of power. And laurel strengths and armed imperative mights, all objects there were great and beautiful. All beings wore a royal stamp of power. That is how we imagine also when you make great, say, heavens, the swargas, they're always beautiful and grand, or even great palaces, a sense of grandeur, the sense of magnificence. There is one aspect in the nature that feels fulfilled. There sat the oligarchies of natural law, proud, violent heads served one calm monarch brow, all the soul's postures donned divinity. So you have oligarchy, different forms of government. Oligarchy is a Greek word, a government by the strong, by the few, by the noble, not government by one man. Monarchy is one man who rules. Oligarchy is a group. The group is made up of men who are strong. There is another kind of oligarchy which was called plutocracy, government by the wealthy. It's not the wealthy. It is those who are strong, the nobles. It doesn't finally work out. For instance, in the Roman Empire, after the killing of Caesar, they divided the empire, was very big. So there were three consuls. They divided it between three consuls. It didn't work. One man had to finally take over, Augustus Caesar. He took up the whole thing. And Mark Antony or Lepidus, they had to go. Antony had to die. Augustus is the great one. Augustus means noble, great. He took the name of Augustus. His name was Octavius Caesar. He was Caesar's nephew. He is the one who becomes the first great emperor of the Roman world. And Rome had conquered the civilized world and ruled over it for centuries. That is the whole secret. So these were the sense of might of superhuman experiences that attract the nature. In fact, Augustus Caesar, I have read somewhere, was Sri Aurobindo. It was he. So they were strong heads, served one calm monarch brow. All came under the domination of one great emperor. And that is the important thing. The Roman world becomes the starting point of the Western civilization. Okay. So all the soul's postures are the states that our inner life takes. Love for power, love for love, love for joy, love for beauty, love for authority, all this is there. They are all often causes for our downfall. Here they are, in this higher plane, they are causes of our human greatness as well. Otherwise, these same things become the starting points of human downfall and failure. Okay, shall we stop there?
He has discussed all the types of
thought. Oh, Sri Aurobindo, you know, he had studied history very, very thoroughly. He was a professor of history himself. Why? It is partly tells you the story of the development of the human, you might say, collectivity, not just the human individual. The human cycle talks about the individual. The ideal of human unity talks about the collectivity. But the conglomeration of nations and countries and how they have shaped the development of the earth in its progress towards knowledge, progress towards science, progress towards all kinds of inventions, all this he has realized. So it is not that we have to turn to the past. We don't have to ever repeat the past. But the past is the launching pad for the future. It is the starting point. From there we move towards the future. So you have to know the launching pad.
Another question. So is this vital for any power? A developed vital is absolutely necessary.
It is absolutely necessary. It is absolutely risky. At the same time. So to be able to surrender, to offer that vital is the most important thing. It is very difficult because it is essentially closest to the projection of the ego. It is where the ego is closest. The ego exists in all the planes. Your body has an ego. Your mind has an ego. But in the vital, that ego formation is absolutely dominant. It is the seat of the ego. Without that, you cannot do anything. With it also, you cannot do anything for any length of time. This is the reason why the title of this canto has two aspects.